on courage. And it's a courage in our spiritual, very unique, responsible search for truth and meaning. Each of us is unique in this journey. Now, Brianna has taught us that our spiritual journey is associated with matters of the heart. Those things that cut to the core of our being, of who we are. So listen for these matters of the heart and the stories that you will hear today. I'd like to introduce Ruth. Now she'll be talking with us first. Now Ruth is a long-time social worker. She's taught social work at WSU for 15 years. Now a few years ago, she was the chairwoman. She's probably afraid what I'm going to say now. She was chairwoman of a search committee to hire two new professors in social work. Now, part of seeking to hire new people is to try to sell the prospective colleague on the richness of your organization. I can remember telling this one candidate, a person that we really wanted to come and join us, I remember telling him that Ruth was someone who wanted to really do something with her life and that he would enjoy working with her. So as part of her journey of service, she's had the opportunity to speak with a number of women of uncommon courage. She will now share with us a few of those stories. Thank you, Ruth.
Thank you, John. And you know, being teaching and such, I'm used to an hour and 20 minutes. So I'm trying to be really careful, and I wrote stuff down so I could keep focus because I just want to be aware of time. But I'll talk to you. Have you ever moved? You know, pack up your life in boxes, suitcases, and move somewhere. I know myself, when I moved up and down the East Coast until sixth grade, lots of different schools. My children had to move the vast distance of 2 miles, and it was traumatic to them. That was their major move in their life. But can you imagine having your whole life packed into two suitcases that weigh no more than maybe 100 pounds each, and that's it? That's your whole life. You're leaving your family, your friends, your siblings behind you so that, you know, that you may never see again. And these are the courageous women I want to talk to you about, the women that I met when I was doing my dissertation. These women were immigrants to the United States, and the courage that they showed in with their lives and how they picked up their lives and moved to another country really demonstrates the courage that I personally would love to imitate. The women that I met were a part of, worked at a garment factory in Syracuse, New York. The Learberry factory, it's now closed, unfortunately. And the women were from all over the world. You could trace immigration history by where they were, because the people that had been there the longest were the Italians. You know, and then you moved your way through to some of the more recent were Vietnamese and some of the others that were there. When I went back to visit, then it was the Haitians were some of the more recent immigrants that were working there. But these women made gorgeous suits, men's suits particularly, Brooks Brothers. I saw them at one time when I was at the Mall of America, costing $500, $800 each, you know, hand-stitched, beautiful work that they had done. And I had the privilege that I could walk the floor of the factory and just observe the process, make informal connections with these individuals. And then I was able to interview in depth 20 women and get to really know them in their lives. Now, a lot of people, if you talk to them about their dissertations, they'll talk in groaning pieces about it. I had a blast. I had so much fun doing my research, writing my research. I had it done in no time. And the people that I got to know, they were from, you know, from Italy, from India, from Vietnam, and every place in between. And what they told me, their stories were so important. And what had really gotten me interested in this was that beforehand, I had gone with Michael to Bangladesh, where he was doing his dissertation research, and we were there for 15 months, and I got to see what life was like for Bangladeshis. Now, it wasn't an immigrant move in any way, because I knew I was going home. But when I came back to the United States, I met some Bangladeshi women and found out about their lives there. Women with master's degrees working in a garment factory doing lowly piecework. If they lived in Bangladesh, they would have owned the factory. And they could have. I talked to them about that. And yet, for them, why did they make this change? What did they do? Now, I can go through a lot. I brought it with me. You know, there is so much with it. But just real simply, some of the things that I saw was that one thing to remember is that women often don't have the choice to whether they immigrate, especially, you know, whether they're married or not. A lot of times the decision was made for them, whether it's their husbands, their families, their siblings. Often that decision for women is often made for them. You know, and it's often that situation of powerlessness that they can be in, where in choosing to make that move or not, the decision was made for them whether to come to the United States. Maybe now it's changed a little bit, but for a lot of the women that I interviewed and I talked to, this was what was happening. And when you talk to them about coming to the U.S., for a lot of them, we often talked about differences. What's different about your life? What's different about what's here? And it was so interesting because I could go through a whole list of things that were different, from the foods that they ate to one of the best examples was talking about weddings. So you have an Italian woman and a woman from India talking about weddings. And the woman from India is talking about this beautiful bride and the whole wedding. You know, there a wedding lasts several days and all that. And finally the pictures come. And so she's showing it to this Italian woman. And here's the bride. The woman is dressed in this beautiful red sari with gold. All of, probably added 60 pounds to her weight, the amount of gold on her. And the woman from Italy looks and goes, "Red? The bride is wearing red?" And she said, and the woman and the Italian woman says, "Our brides wear white." And the woman from India says, "What? That's the color of widows." And these exchanges were just fabulous to see. And you know, and part of it was just wonderful because the comparisons that they did, you know, were partly these were their friends that they became, you know, that they got to see more often than other people because they worked long hours. You know, usually from 7:30 in the morning till 5 at night, plus usually 6 days a week was the time that they were there. But, you know, and at first they would be kind of tentative, but later it became much more, you know, sometimes out of boredom of their workplace, and it was something that they could share and would be a part of. But yet one of the pieces that also came really true were the similarities that were there. And one of the most important similarities that I really found were that all these women were there to improve the lives of their children. And that how they were really concerned that when they came, they wanted better opportunities for them, especially if their children were female, for girls. Issues of education were so important and the opportunities that would come with it. And it was important for them, you know, sometimes it was just exciting to hear the excitement about good things happening. Sometimes there is also the frustration that the child wasn't doing quite what they wanted. Or we end up, you know, getting a job doing the same thing that they were doing and weren't able to advance. And so for a lot of them, it was really difficult. But for the immigrant women that left behind, one of the things that they really left behind was they left behind where they were part of the majority culture in their country. And they came to a place where now they were the minority. The person that's often despised. The person where now they're the other. They're the individual that in our legislation we call them aliens. And, I mean, I hear alien, I think Sigourney Weaver in a gross movie. And so it's really difficult for them when they come here. And for us to realize how our culture is not really supportive of immigrants. You know, we do talk about, you know, the melting pot. You know, and that's what we should all be. But realize that that idea came back in the 30s when most of the people immigrating were from Europe. So there wasn't the same difference that we have now in skin color that we have now with our immigrants. And that now that is just a real change that has happened with who actually immigrates. And one of the things with our immigrants is we need to realize how important they are to our economy. There's been several times I've seen over the last years about where the immigrants that live in New York City threaten to stop working, to show their power, with both illegal and undocumented immigrants. Because if we didn't have them, our fields wouldn't be picked, our chickens wouldn't be plucked, our hotel rooms wouldn't be cleaned, and that how we really do need both our documented and our undocumented immigrants. And just so you know, if you wanted to follow the rules and come here as a legal immigrant, like from Mexico, it would take you 30, 40 years because of the paperwork and everything that's there. Recently, a young woman who had been brought to the U.S. when she was a young child went to visit her representative, Representative Dana Rohrenbacher, regarding her immigration status. His response to her, he yelled at her, "I hate illegals," leaving her in tears. And this is just within the last week. Little regard was given to the fact that this is the only country she's ever known, and that we need them. And this is the mentality of our Congress. I do want you to know, we've got some good people here in our own county. Karen Sonneman, our county attorney, Kevin Carney, who's with our local police staff, who's also part of Project Find, has put together a piece in their committee pushing for legislation on how important it is for especially undocumented immigrants to be able to get a true driver's license. Because they're going to drive, and it's better if they know the rules, they know what's happening, because it's better for all of us. And even as officials, these are elected officials, but that they see that as being beneficial to all of us. And I think that that is something that we can support within our community, and I encourage. And if any of you are interested, I have a flyer that I can fax you or email you regarding what their position is and what they're pushing for. A similar piece has passed through Illinois, and it's something that they're looking at here. One of the things to realize is that immigration is not a crime. Immigrants are courageous people, and who've kind of stepped over the line, and that we as the people in the majority really need to speak out, and we reap the benefits from them. And so what we need to do is reward their courage and support them, and we need to recognize them for their courage in doing that. And I'll leave it at that.
Very good, Ruth. Thank you. And we'll have a chance to talk to Ruth in just a few minutes. We want to give you a chance to also choose from Dennis Carter's remarks and Ruth's. But she certainly challenged us as, quote, majority people in the country to be people of courage. Thank you. Dennis has been a counselor in Winona for nearly 30 years. One of the areas of his profession is working with those struggling with chemical addiction. This is a spiritual practice. His work, dealing with matters of the heart. Now, I will recall a story Dennis told us some years ago of diving off a rock cliff and feeling the hairs of his chest brush against a boulder. With that as background, I believe we'll be in for a rich time for the next 10 minutes. Thank you, Dennis.
That's sometimes to testosterone poisoning.
I was going to stand out in front, but I see that we're being recorded, so I will stay up here and wave my arms up here instead of closer to you. My theme is the courage to be curious. And I'm going to read to you what I wrote about that. I'm going to try to consolidate, and this is to keep you from running on and on here because I've only got 10 minutes. But I believe that the core issue of having courage to be curious is a foundational adult skill that invites us to take responsibility for our adult relationship with ourselves, with other people, with our environment, and our higher power, / God, / loving energy, however we imagine that to be. And because of my profession, which is actually broader than just chemical dependency, that's one of my licensures. I've worked in the mental health field since 1968, also off and on, different clinical settings, and my licensed clinical social worker is in Wisconsin, so I have to remember which side of the bridge I'm on when I consult and so forth, and or I'll get myself in trouble. But I do a fair amount of consultation work in Wisconsin and other states where I have reciprocity, and help people and bear witness to their struggle to deal with their addictions, the many faces of addiction, substance and behavioral, that result from trauma of many kinds, shapes and sizes. But essentially trauma extends to a lot of things, and some of you may have had experience with that, and I'll briefly talk about some of mine today, and that the courage to be curious about all that. But basically, trauma, anything that wounds us, because the word trauma comes from the Greek word wounding. And sometimes the trauma isn't the classic PTSD where a terrible thing happens to us, or a family, or a friend, death, or heavy injury, or losing a house, losing a marriage. Sometimes the trauma is spread out over a long period of time, starting in childhood in terms of rigid parenting or no parenting, so abandonment, unintentional neglect, sexual abuse, religious abuse, emotional, verbal, and of course the all-time great that extends throughout our culture and continues is this thing called negative drama, toxic negative drama, to the point where I don't even want to turn on the news anymore, and I find myself censoring, don't open that. That's just more of the same that we're hearing all the time. Bad guys, good guys, a lack of ability to find common ground. And in families where there's very little common ground found between the partners, the parents, and constant negative drama, that in itself is very traumatizing to young people, and it was for me. And I say this without judging my parents, because I forgave my parents a long time ago and was very blessed to have a very loving grandmother that filled in the holes for me a lot, which allowed me, I think, to have courage to be curious about this and to extend that courage to my clients in a good way. But almost all the things I mentioned to you happened in my family. It was a very wounded family, and many generations, as I discovered later when I started researching the family, not to pin the tail on the donkey or to blame anybody, but just to understand more about what happened, when did it happen, what was the impact on me? As I look back and imagine, what was I thinking when these abandonment issues were happening and the abuses and so forth, what kind of a context did I put that in? Well, being very young, the biggest drama happened for me between the ages of birth and about 3 years of age during the World War II. And I'm dating myself here. I was born in 43, and there was a lot still going on at that time. And this was a multi-member family situation in a small house that was built for probably a couple and the two children they had, which was my aunt and my uncle. But along with that was my mother and father, myself and my older sister. The two aunts were both very traumatized in the same ways that I was. My grandfather was very traumatized and a late-stage alcoholic by that time. And my grandmother, my maternal grandmother, was sick and dying in the family. And, excuse me, my paternal grandmother was sick and dying, and my maternal grandmother was there as a nurse taking care of her. So, I mean, this is all in the family situation. And constant drama, constant fighting, constant people boo-hooing and getting depressed and being highly anxious. And of course, I took a lot of that on because I was a sit back and watch kid. I didn't talk until I was 3 years old. And when I did start to talk, I talked in complete sentences. That's what they tell me anyway. So I was withholding a lot of my truth. And a very anxious child. And was an anxious adult until about age 40. I decided to start modeling all the stuff I had learned about addiction and recovery and started seriously working a recovery process, which was very holistic in nature. And I do have a diagram of that for anybody who's interested in taking a look at that afterwards. I don't have time to go into it in any depth, but basically it's a full circle that helped me get to and have the courage to be curious about what, when, how. And then the why emerges from all that. The why has emerged out of that curiosity and that courage. But basically it's a full circle. A full circle being us as a holistic being with the two top parts of the two top quadrants being our cognitive abilities and the other half being our social spiritual abilities to connect. It's all about connection. Putting love into action toward ourselves, others, our environment, and connecting with a higher power and so forth. All about connection. And then the bottom part, which is our child, is our emotional self and our physical self. And when we get into a recovery process, we're using our adult to guide us. But if our adult is highly damaged, then we have to, of course, rely on the adult or somebody else to give us some feedback and help us stay on the path and not puddle, to encourage us to also let go of all the ways we distract ourselves with our substance and behavior addictions and dramas and so forth. And so the adult in recovery informs the child, but the child also informs the adult. And that's something I paid real close attention to and continue to do that. I start my day off with deep breathing and in relaxation, out tension, in love, out fear, and so forth. I have a whole thing I go through. And it helps me to stay grounded and not give in to fear, because as a male, I was programmed by watching my dad and my grandfather and the men in my life cover fear with anger and sadness. Cover the fear with anger and sadness. And so what I had to do is go down, get rid of the anger, stop being angry all the time, look at what am I afraid of, which is the theme of the book today. So thanks so much for that book. It's perfect. Beautiful book. What am I scared of? And then I had to examine, well, what am I thinking? What are my scary thoughts? Which is the cognitive. I'm going to go the other way because it's reversed for you. So I'll go with the cognitive part first. What am I scared of? What are my scary beliefs, my core beliefs that keep me censored and scared? And how do I invite myself to feel then? How do I invite fear? And then around, how does my body react to that? What's my reaction? And how does that guide how I nurture myself or not nurture myself with movement and food and meditation, prayer, and so forth? And then finally, how does that allow me or disallow me to disconnect from myself, others, the environment, and my higher power? It's a full circle system I developed in the 80s. And I've been tweaking it ever since, and I have an example of it here if you're interested. So that took a lot of courage for me to start doing that at age 40, because it meant challenging a lot of the family and cultural messages that I've gotten. It invited me to look at the dysfunction I was playing out in my marriage at the time. I'm not blaming my ex-wife. We were both wounded people doing the dance, not of intimacy, but the dance of dysfunction for a long time. And we had our good moments, and my parents had their good moments too. They were functional in some ways. I don't like the word dysfunctional. I like the word wounded. So they were wounded. They passed their wounds on to me. And I've really worked hard at owning my woundedness with my adult children and encouraging them to look at how they may be wounded from their experience with me and two wives and the culture. Because my two biological children are girls, women now, of course, and have had to deal with that. And but they're both willing to, and so are my stepchildren too. I got two female stepchildren, and they're all willing to use counseling and ask for help, which I think is wonderful. And as well as my son, my stepson, and I continue to be there for him in a very physical and affectionate way, because I was not given that. The men in my family were terrified to hug. If they did, it was kind of thing. The stiff handshake was just fine. So I give my son a lot of hugs and tell him I really do a good job catching him doing things right, because he's close by and I get to see him a lot. So how am I doing for time?
Time? About 1 minute.
1 minute?
Yeah.
Okay. So so let me just quickly review what the curiosity piece is. One, it invites us to give up shameful shoulds and censorship from our family culture. I gave some examples of that. It invites us to what, when, and how, and the many faces of addiction that get in the way of understanding that and acting on that and filling up the hole with something positive. It allows us to go full circle, which I did with you visually here, imagining curiosity, which is curiosity, imagining all these things about how we witnessed a lot of woundedness, rigid, shameful core beliefs, and so forth. And then finally, it invites us to get past emotional, physical, spiritual pain by accepting what was and what is. And I call this holistic restoration, rebuilding over time. The full circle is holistic intelligence, which allows us to become holistically restored over time. It's a process. And I like the Serenity Prayer, and I'm just going to tweak it, and then I'm going to sit down or stand here and take questions.
Well, you sit down when you're finished.
Okay, I'll sit down. Okay. All right. God, higher power, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage and curiosity, that's the tweak, to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. I'll leave you with that thought.
All right. Now, some response to Ruth and Dennis's remarks, which you might have.
I would just say, I think it does. I've never thought about this before. I think of myself as being a curious person, but how curious am I? And I think that's the courage that when you start to look over the cliff, not just at it.
Right, how much permission do I give myself to be curious?
How far do I go?
And speak my truth without blame and judgment.
Sweet are the virtues of adversity, as long as they're not too tough. It's an ancient Jewish saying, sweet are the virtues of adversity. So what are some of the sweetnesses of adversity from some of the immigrant refugee perspective?
What isn't? It's all individualized.
What did you say?
For each woman, it's individualized.
Yes, but what would be a sense of?
One thing I was just flipping through my book and looking at, and for women from who look like terrorists and aren't, they have the same skin color, the same hair coloring, and yet this is one of the adversities that they run. They have nothing to do with people who are who are seen as the terrorists who, you know, at that time, when I wrote my dissertation, it was when we had had the first bombing of the World Trade Center, and how that has just become even more so. And they have nothing to do with that, yet just by visual, people think that they are.
But your question was about the sweetness
of
adversity.
What were some of the benefits of this really lives of great adversity?
Yeah.
There are a certain amount of benefits
that
accrue to us as long as they're not too difficult.
They're children.
Well, even when they're difficult, I think that's part of the creating safety to be fully who we are, which is the last statement in the chalice reading. And that's what we get from good therapy, from good friendship, from sponsorship. Sometimes grandmothers or grandfathers can be provide some of that for us. I think, but the courage takes away, the courage is to admit it, to tell my story over time, and then let it in, let the love back in. Because with woundedness and adversity comes a lot of anxiety and fear of intimacy.
Well, I think just the learning that comes from that. I mean, to me, that's what I think of. You know, who was it? You know, Thomas Edison said he learned, you know, 1,001 ways not to make a light bulb kind of thing, or something like that. I mean, there are no mistakes. There's just lessons.
Lots of opportunities to grow, yeah. As long as you keep a sense of humor, too, that's important.
Yeah. We just happened to watch the movie Argo this week, and okay. I remember the scene of an Iranian man being kicked and beat up because of what had happened after the hostage crisis. And, you know, after 9/11, the courage of Muslims to welcome other Americans into a dialogue with them. Tremendously risky. And yet they did that. And there were some costs to them, but they also were able to reach out to the American community, the American community to them, other Americans. And I just think, you know, risks like that are just so phenomenal in history that they would do that. Mm-hmm. And there were benefits.
Mm-hmm. Yes, Deb, thank you.
You know, one of the Buddhist teachings is to welcome our suffering because it makes us more compassionate people.
What was the first part of that?
Well, one of the Buddhist teachings is to welcome our suffering because it makes us more compassionate people. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, it's kind of like she said that just the opportunity to learn, because even just with this broken arm, I realized, you know, I have to brush my teeth with my left hand, try to comb my hair with my left hand, and so I'm much more compassionate to people with a disability who have that all the time. I just have it for a couple months, but it's made me more aware. So, that's a blessing.
Last comment, yes.
With the young men and women in college I work with who have lost someone, the ones that are really resilient are those that are eventually able to see something they've gained from it. Yeah. Not that it was worth the cost, but I think that's a real key in resiliency, to be open to something positive coming in. And for them it's often compassion or personal perspective.
These are matters of the heart on our spiritual journey that I think we're talking about here. You look like you wanted to barge in here. Yes.
Just maybe a closing comment. Another Jewish rabbi saying where that he thanks God in advance for all the blessings that he might not recognize when they come in the future. At the time, they don't seem like blessings.
Very good. Thank you.
All right, ready for our second song, Nancy. What is that again?
It is number 352, Mind is Stillness.
352.